Good afternoon. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News podcasting today from Sausalito, California. It's an absolutely spectacular afternoon. I had a very busy day in clinic. It's been a busy week, in fact. And an experience with a patient yesterday prompted the podcast today that focuses on the history part of the history and physical examination. Now, the term history, we all know through our education in school. We think of U.S. history or wherever you're from, the history of your country and world history, etc. In the realm of medicine, the history refers to the information gathering session between a patient and a physician, such that the physical examination and the evaluation and diagnostic plans can be staged or established based on that information. When I was in medical school, one of the professors who taught us history and physical examination in the second year said that if you listen carefully and know what you're listening for and ask the right questions, you can determine the diagnosis 90% of the time by the history alone. That's probably not far from the truth, but I'll add that the physical examination helps significantly, as does the subsequent laboratory and radiographic investigation of a patient with pituitary disorders, for example. One of the pet peeves that I have is a lot of physicians, especially those in training, will refer to the patient as a poor historian. And they use that term to indicate that patients don't really relate their medical history very well. In fact, a historian is one who studies a history, so the historian is the physician, and it's well taken that some patients can't provide their history. They don't have the sophisticated understanding about medicine that physicians have, and they can't determine relevance of symptoms and signs. Furthermore, we all experience things very differently. You could talk to 10 patients with, say, cardiac pain due to coronary artery disease, and they would all have a different pain. And what one might refer to as pain, another one might think of as indigestion or discomfort or sharp or stabbing or crushing or what have you. So we as physicians know that as individuals, we all interpret similar symptoms and signs differently and might have some difficulty in relating to the physician, something that the physician can understand based on their experience with lots of patients, or maybe even their own personal experience with pain or some other symptom that the patient might report. Fatigue is a common example. Everybody has a different notion of what fatigue means. Some people, fatigue means that they get tired when they try to do things. Other people say they're fatigued when they really mean they're just tired all the time. So this is one of the things that makes the history very difficult to ascertain and to be exact and precise, and it leads to some physicians thinking that the patient's a poor historian when it really is the physician might be the poor historian. But with that said, just keep in mind as you talk to your physicians that the history is this nebulous thing. It's a period of communication where doctors and patients get together to find out what's bothering the patient, what the cause might be, and how might it best be treated. So more on that later, but now I want to tell you about a patient. And you all have medical histories, a record of your testing, evaluations, etc. And when you are referred to a specialist, oftentimes a specialist will choose to look at that information or not. I'll tell you that as a tertiary specialist, namely a pituitary endocrinologist who specializes in a very small field of endocrinology, sometimes the history presented to me is not accurate. We saw this all the time in training. You know, as a resident, you'd go see the patient and spend an hour with the patient and have the history sorted out and arrive at a diagnosis or what might be important or relevant. You present the patient to the attending. The attending asks the patient a few simple questions, and you realize that, yeah, I was way off. The attending came in and got the true history, did it better than I did. And we used to call that the attending sign, by the way. But it was a period of education and learning for us to learn to sort through relevance and to ask the right questions. But one of the things I'm concerned about when I read records from referring physicians is they may not have asked the right questions, or the questions that I would choose to ask given a patient's particular presentation. And I've seen histories by physicians that were either inadequate, incomplete, or totally off base. So when I'm looking through referring physician records, I take a look to see what the general consensus is as to why the patient's being referred, but I tend not to let that influence my decision making. I want to take my history or understand the history in conjunction with available laboratory data and radiographic tests and my physical examination to come up with a conclusion. And I'm not the type of physician who's generally going to accept what other physicians have stated they think is wrong with the patient unless I'm in agreement with that. So I think the seasoned clinicians are that way. Those who are junior clinicians probably need to work to become that way, recognizing that if you're going to be a specialist and offer something far and above what a primary physician would offer in regards to history. This particular patient that I saw was sent to me for evaluation of what they said were low cortisol levels. And the story was that they had elucidated that the patient had received a steroid injection, subsequently had low cortisol levels, felt poorly, in fact, felt poorly prior to the injection when I took my history. But at any rate, they gave him hydrocortisone and he felt better. They tried to stop the hydrocortisone based on cortisol levels, and ultimately he barely passed a traditional ACTH stimulation test, and they said he didn't need hydrocortisone any longer. He stopped the medication, felt terribly so, asked to be put back on the medication, but was sent to me to evaluate this situation because the stimulation test was normal. Patient felt better on steroids. We don't want to give them unless you approve it. So that's what the patient was supposed to come to see me about. And had I not really wanted to spend any time with the patient or getting additional information, I might have looked at the stimulation test and said, you know what, your levels are fine, you don't need steroids, and sent the patient home. But, you know, being a curious type of a guy, I met with the patient and he explained what I had learned from reading the record of the referring physician, and it was pretty accurate and it matched, and he seemed to be able to provide a good history. And I had obtained, he had talked about in the history about how he had had a low testosterone level on one occasion and really had symptoms and signs preceding steroid therapy and just didn't feel very well. So I decided, as I usually do anyway, to take a look at the labs that we had ordered in advance of the visit. We tend to just check everything with regards to the pituitary, figuring that if people come here for an opinion, we want to be able to base that opinion on a full set of data. And his cortisol level was mid-normal. His thyroid functions were low normal. His testosterone also low normal. And his IGF-1 level was in the normal range, but it was frankly low in my opinion. It was 60, which is quite low normal. And generally for people his age, average would be about 175. So I was curious about his pituitary functions. I'd had the opportunity to look at an MRI that showed no anatomical abnormalities of his pituitary gland, but I started asking some questions, and what I learned was that he had hemochromatosis, and he was having phlebotomy every so often to decrease his iron stores in his body so that he didn't have toxicity from the iron. Now, his disease was appropriately treated, but the thing to know is that some people with hemochromatosis do have hypopituitarism as a consequence of the illness. It's usually gonadal dysfunction and some growth hormone dysfunction. Rarely the other pituitary hormones are out. But I talked more, and I learned that years ago he had had an accident. He was on a bicycle and was hit by an automobile and had a concussion, lost consciousness, required hospitalization for a while, extensive rehabilitation, followed by several surgical procedures on his shoulder. But his cognition never really fully recovered. He started losing muscle mass, having easy fatigability when he exercised, and was tired all the time. He also had some body composition changes with an increase in the intra-abdominal fat, and he just wasn't feeling as if he was ever normal again. And again, his physician had ascribed all of this to his steroid issues, failing to recognize that as many as a third of patients after head trauma will have one or more anterior pituitary hormone deficiencies years out from the traumatic event. So suddenly I'm thinking that, you know, here's the power of the history, just sitting and talking to the patient, and he comes for one thing and now you're believing something entirely different about his health care and his health, thinking that he probably has partial hypopituitarism as a consequence of the head trauma and maybe the hemochromatosis, probably certainly has growth hormone deficiency, has hypogonadism based on symptoms and signs and a prior low testosterone and low normal testosterone levels with me, and may have mild central hypothyroidism. And the issue of the cortisol levels and his ACTH stimulation test becomes more curious. We know that patients who have partial central adrenal insufficiency and require steroids to feel well sometimes will have a normal response to a traditional ACTH stimulation test. And the proper test to be performed is a low-dose ACTH stimulation test, which sort of correlates well with the gold standard, the insulin-induced hypoglycemia test. So as a consequence of taking a good history and listening to this patient talk, I decided to proceed with a low-dose ACTH stimulation test and a glucagon stimulation test. And once we have those results, we'll meet again and ferret out exactly what is going on with pituitary functions and decide on the necessity of hormone replacement. So, you know, I was fortunate to have a scribe with me who's been accepted to medical school, and I was talking with the scribe about how his case serves an excellent example as to why you have to take a history and why you have to develop your skills of communicating with patients in order to be able to take a history that can be useful to both the doctor and the patient's families, of course. And it got me thinking about the history and reviewing some of the things I had said earlier in my mind and some of the recommendations I would give to those of you who are patients. So first off, in regards to physicians, clearly physicians need to learn to listen to patients and ask the right questions. And one of the ways to learn to ask the right questions is to see a lot of patients, pay attention to what people are saying, look things up, and learn to relate and understand the symptoms and signs of the pathophysiology of disease, and learn what's really truly associated and what's relevant, for example, for each disease process or state that you might be involved in treating. This can be difficult. It takes years of experience to gain that, and it takes refining one's observational skills and listening skills to be able to perform an accurate and a good history, sorting through relevance. I had the opportunity to review that in my mentor, Dr. Gary Wand at Hopkins, who would sit down and casually ask a few questions and was able to surmise the history and the diagnosis with far fewer questions than I was asking at the time. And he seemed to know the proper questions to ask. And I asked him, how do you do that? And he says, it's just experience. And he said, you learn to recognize that a question is a tool. You want to use appropriate tools. You don't ask a bunch of random questions just to cover the bases. You ask appropriate questions because each question is a tool. And the results of using that tool lead to the selection of the next tool to use. And I really liked that mantra, if you will, and that approach to patient care, recognizing that a question during a history is just like a test. Sometimes the tests aren't indicated, so you wouldn't ask particular questions. For example, if a patient looks like they have acromegaly, when you're taking your history, you're not going to ask about symptoms of Cushing syndrome unless they also look like they have Cushing syndrome. Or if they have Cushing syndrome, you're not going to ask about symptoms and signs of hyperthyroidism due to a TSH-producing adenoma, for example. So that that seasoned clinician's approach to asking questions and listening is key. Being able to take something that a patient says and formulate a list of questions in your mind that you need to go through, where truly the physician thinks in his mind or her mind, if this, then that, if this, then that, after every single question, and that guides our questioning and ultimately allows us to arrive at some sort of decision-making about further questions, physical exam findings, and other data to be obtained in the evaluative stage of the history and physical examination. I think it's important for patients to realize that this is how physicians work and it's how medicine best works. We're interested in hearing what you have to say, but oftentimes, you know, patients are not medical professionals and they don't understand the relevance. All they can do is present what's going on with them and help us start our line of questioning to sort of get to the bottom of what's going on and to arrive at other solutions to problems later on. It's important that you tell us what's going on, what your symptoms and signs are, but recognize that we may deem some of them irrelevant to the situation at hand feel that it's not related to the pituitary disease and it's something that we acknowledge as a problem but should be evaluated further by your primary or treating physician because it's not related to the disease process we're taking care of. An example of that is a patient who came to me and he had hypopituitarism and I felt like he was appropriately treated and he told me that he just felt like his hormones were off and I listened to his symptoms and signs, and I said, I honestly think that your treatment is right on target. I don't think there's anything wrong with the current replacement doses of your hormones. And he accepted that. He says, what do you think's going on? And I says, it sounds to me like you have a cardiac problem. And I wasn't entirely sure what he had at the time, but I strongly advised him to see a cardiologist. And he says, well, my primary physician doesn't really think it's a cardiac problem, so what should I do? And I said, I want you to see a cardiologist. And he saw a cardiologist, and he ended up having a disorder called pericarditis, which is an inflammation of the sac around the heart. And he required surgery to correct that, indicating that that was a significant finding. His health improved drastically, greatly, after he had the appropriate surgery. There's a classic example of how his symptoms weren't true related to his pituitary disease process. We're all human beings. We have multiple disease processes at times. Lots of things can go wrong at the same time. And just because you have pituitary disease doesn't mean that your symptoms are related to the pituitary disorder that's being evaluated. I see this a lot on Facebook, for example, in some of the groups where people will say, I have this symptom or that symptom. And my doctor didn't pay attention to that. And about 10 other people will chime in. I have the same thing. And ultimately the discussion sort of trails off into why don't these doctors recognize this is related to our pituitary disease? And I read those posts sometimes and think to myself, well, I wouldn't think that's related to pituitary disease either. This is more of a thing about being human and having this or that wrong in addition to having pituitary disease. So it's important as a patient to understand that perspective and that not everything that ails you is related to your pituitary disorder. But you need to provide your history so someone can make that determination and then recommend further evaluation and management if so. As I think it's a danger to want to ascribe everything to pituitary disease, even if your physician says that it's not, because that approach is going to lead to not being evaluated for something else, and mistakes are going to be made, and you may end up with a delay in diagnosis of some other particular disorder, as in that patient that I saw who had the pericarditis and required heart surgery. So, as a patient, when you think about providing your history to your physician, we like to see things in a timeline. We want to know, when did your symptoms first start? How severe are they? How did they progress over time? What are associated symptoms? What makes those symptoms or signs worse? What makes them better, if anything, especially if you've tried things, home remedies or other medications or whatever. We also want to know what other physicians might have thought about things over time and whether they offered any treatments. And generally, how it affects your life and how it affects your family and your workplace, etc. And then we'll do the rest. We'll ask the right questions to sort of piece together the rest of the puzzle And it's okay to write your symptoms down and to write a document for the physician to review. We can review those really quickly, and it actually speeds up the process, and we can start focusing on what seems to be relevant based on what we already know about your situation, reviewing laboratory data or radiographs, for example. And it also lets us have a document that we can scan into your electronic medical record as, here's what the patient presented with. And you know, then we focused on these issues and arrived at our conclusion based on this particular history that we want to document as the history of present illness, that we call it. At any rate, that's food for thought for both myself and all of you, and hopefully any other physicians who will take a listen to this podcast. As usual, give us your thoughts. Respond to this. Tell us what you think. Tell us about your experiences. And in particular, we'd like to hear, just because I think it's something to focus on, if you had symptoms that you thought were due to your pituitary disease, but they turned out to be due to something else, because I think that this sort of information helps the collective body of patients and physicians who listen to these podcasts and participate in the discussions on Facebook or on our site at Pituitary World News to recognize that that it is important to track down symptoms and signs and to try to figure out what's ailing the patient, and not doing what a lot of physicians seem to like to do, which is to tell patients it must be your hormones or your pituitary, even when we as pituitary specialists have straightened all of that out. We often send a patient back to the primary doctor. No, it's not the hormones. It's not the pituitary tumor. Everything is great in that realm, so you have to chase something down. But I think it's important for patients to recognize that and to share their experiences so others can learn from those experiences too. As usual, we like to hear from you, so think about participating in the discussion. Once again, this is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News. Thanks a lot for listening. Have a wonderful day.